As you know, we're in the middle of Advent, and we are starting this series or continuing the series about what would it mean like to look at this story from the perspective of the people who were there. And so kind of thinking through, last week we looked at Zechariah and Elizabeth in particular, a little bit at Mary. We'll come back to Mary because she's important in this story. But this week we're looking at Herod and the Magi, which is sort of an interesting place to look. We're kind of accustomed to the nativity, right? We see this picture of angels and shepherds and wise men and so forth. And one of the things that I think we don't often think about the nativity is that it's this kind of crazy mashup of these stories that they conveniently tell the whole story while getting a lot of the details wrong and leaving out some important points. So the Nativity has shepherds and wise men and angels all at a pristine stable, all at the same time, kneeling around a peaceable newborn Jesus and a remarkably composed Mary and Joseph. And of course, in the Gospel of Luke, where part of this comes from, the angels never show up at the stable, if it is even a stable. The wise men or the Magi are only in the Gospel of Matthew, which never mentions a stable or inn or census at all. And it's really clear that the wise men aren't there for the birth of Jesus, because Matthew 2 begins with the phrase, after Jesus was born, the wise men show up in Jerusalem. So why do we tell this story this way? I think maybe there's a couple reasons. Probably because it's convenient. It's a convenient simplification in which the details that are lost in the translation maybe don't seem so important. It gives us an overview and a story that is easy to tell and represent and gets to what we've come to believe is the heart of the Christmas story. And maybe that's true, but maybe what's left out or blended in so we can't see it are some pretty important parts of this story. We don't very often talk about Joseph's dreams. We sure don't like to talk about Herod very much. I imagined him this week lurking outside of the Nativity. He's sort of hidden in this picture there, but he does have a bright red robe on. Or worse still, we don't even like to think at all about Herod's armies rampaging through Bethlehem and killing babies. In fact, as I went to try to find a picture, I went with this 16th century Dutch thing, which doesn't really tell you anything about it being the Massacre of the Innocents, but everything else just felt way too harsh to put up among us. And maybe it's easier to overlay our own filters and templates onto this story than to enter into it fully. A story about cuddly babies being born in idyllic Bethlehem is much nicer than a story about infanticide. A story about a humble teenage girl willingly becoming the mother of God and her noble, chagrined, yet faithful husband is much easier to palate than the foreign astrologers who show up guided by what the Old Testament describes as a practice of the occult. We like to see God's work as gentle and kind and innocuous through sweet babies, not as earth-shaking challenges about to who and how God communicates, or a narrative that will push us to look at our own faithfulness and desire for control. In short, we like warm, fuzzy stories better than we like provocative ones. And one of the disadvantages of living 2,000 years after a story is written that it's hard to get back to the actual story, because we have all the encumbrances of interpretation and retelling that have been placed around it. And even if we push past the oversimplification of the nativity scene, we run into all kinds of speculation, which over time we've come to think of as fact. Think about the wise men, the Magi. Sometimes we even call them kings. And we really don't know a lot about these folks from Matthew, but that doesn't stop Christians over time from developing detailed narratives about them, including supposing that three gifts means that there were three Magi, and now we have names for each of them, the symbolic meaning of each of their gifts, their separate countries of origin, making them seem like the first United Nations councils on messianic birth, their particular fashion choices and colors, they're not all bathrobes, and so on and so forth. They went from being magi, which is what Matthew calls them, which is pretty simple, which is priests from Persia, likely Zoroastrians, which is a great thing to learn to say, Zoroastrians. They went from being to being kings from India and Babylon and Arabia. So why do I bring this up? In part to remind us that sometimes what we think is the definitive biblical understanding of something isn't always really biblical. And in part to remember that we too are inherently going to put our own lenses and filters on the story. And we should be aware that we're doing that. Because otherwise you end up with, you know, Zoroastrian wise men that look like Zorro. And in part to invite us to, what is Matthew really saying here? What's actually in the text so that we're hearing the original story and allowing that space to form us? There's plenty to chew on in Matthew 2, so here's a brief overview of what happens. Jesus has been born. This has been confirmed in Matthew 1, so this is the context that Matthew 2 starts in. Remember, after Jesus was born. And now in Jerusalem, the Magi show up, asking where the king of the Jews is, because through astrology, they know this is happening. This doesn't sit well with Herod, as he's currently king of the Jews. So folks showing up and asking, where is the king of the Jews who's been born, is not sitting well with him. And anybody reading Matthew would have to know that Herod is, to put it lightly, an unsavory dude. Not just for the part that's coming about killing babies, but because he is the definition of a bloody tyrant. He's killed three of his sons and his first wife in order to hold on to the throne. And he's doing this in cahoots with Rome, which doesn't make him particularly popular in Judea. This, therefore, is an awkward situation. Matthew tells us that Herod was disturbed, a light word for it, by this information. And Matthew says, and all of Jerusalem with him. Which is a hint to what happens when you have a despotic ruler who's angry. That might affect the rest of the population. Herod's usual reactions of his power being challenged, with that context, we might read that as an understatement, that folks were disturbed. Herod's first act is to gather the priests and scholars and try to figure out what is going on. Where is the Messiah supposed to be born? You can hear, you can see Herod's, wheels turning in his head. Does this affect me? And if so, how negatively? And the priests and teachers of law respond with Micah 5, verses 2 through 4, specifying Bethlehem as the place where the Messiah is to come from. Herod duly tells the Magi to search in Bethlehem, and being clever, he pretends that he too wants to worship the Messiah, while all the while planning to dispose of the Messiah. The Magi proceed to Bethlehem, where they see the star over the house and find Jesus and worship him, giving the gifts they've brought. And the narrative about them ends rather abruptly. They're warned in a dream not to return to Herod, so they head a different way. Joseph, too, is warned in a dream that he needs to leave. And so Joseph and Mary and Jesus head to Egypt to escape the coming persecution. Herod, on learning that the Magi have seen through his cleverness, declares that all the male babies under 2 in Bethlehem are to be killed, fulfilling not only the fears that had disturbed him and Jerusalem, but the prophecy of Jeremiah as well, a voice heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Chapter 2 ends with Joseph and Mary and Jesus moving from Egypt to Galilee because Herod's son is now in power and maybe the threat is over. So there's the overview, and in some ways this is a pretty straight-ahead story. In other ways, it's complicated. There's pieces in this story in Matthew's original audience would have found it difficult to cope with. Starting with the Magi. What are these foreign astrologers doing in a nice Jewish story? These aren't supposed to be the first folk to recognize that the Messiah has come. That should have been the teachers of the law or the priests. These are people who read the stars, people who are seeking after knowledge in ways that the Old Testament is really clear that this isn't okay. It's forbidden by the law. These are people from a totally different faith background. And we take the Magi for granted. But this is a big deal. To have foreign folks, outsiders in almost every way, showing up. And Matthew is saying something important here. Perhaps this Messiah thing isn't limited to people that Israel assumes that it would be limited to. The second thing to notice, and again, this would have been obvious to the people that Matthew was originally writing to, is that the Messiah is directly threatening Herod and, by association, Rome's power. This threat to power is bolstered by the reference to the prophecies coming true. From the prophecies in Micah 5, God is bringing forth someone who will bring about peace. There's also an inherent reference to Isaiah 60 with the gifts that the Magi bring. And it's about the restoration of Jerusalem to a place of prominence, of economic power and political power. There's the prophecy of the massacre of the innocents. And there's the prophecy about out of Egypt I will call my son. There's a prophecy about Jesus being a Nazarene. And all of this points to Herod's and Rome's power being threatened, not by a usurper, but by the very plan and intention of God. And in this story, it says clearly God's intention will not be subverted. It won't be threatened. Even with Herod's scheming, God is still accomplishing what God intends. The Magi are warned, and Joseph is warned. And so despite Herod's willingness to commit atrocities to maintain power, God is still going to do what God wants. This then is more than just a story about strange and noble visitors who honor and confirm Jesus' claim to being the Messiah. It's a bigger story than just about one despotic ruler. It's a story about how God chooses to interact with the world and how we're inclined to respond. It's a story about power and how we're tempted and corrupted by it. And I do want to say, as I thought about this, to make analogies between ourselves and Herod is maybe a bit of a jump. So don't hear that. I don't think any of us have killed our kids and wives to maintain power. But there is a connection here of what are we willing to do to maintain our own control and power. So temper that somehow. This is a story about who's in and who's out. Who will God communicate with and how? Perhaps God shows up in ways that we don't think God can. Perhaps God shows up to people we don't think God can or should speak to. Perhaps we stand to be threatened by God showing up and changing the balance of power. So what do we do with all of this? There's a dizzying amount of trivial information surrounding this story. We can learn a ton of things about Herod because the Romans kept pretty good historical records. There's all kinds of side trails off of about the wise men and the symbolism that surrounds them. But, you know, we're not here for trivia or to finally solve all the mysteries of the side stories generated here, even if we could. We come to this story hoping to be formed by it, to deepen our trust and relationship with God, and to be challenged by what Matthew is telling us. And it seems to me there's several things that we can say that Matthew is saying here. The first is that God shows up how and where God wants to. God doesn't limit God's self to who or how we think God should communicate. God uses things that we think are unusable. God sends messages with folks that we think God shouldn't or can't use. God shows up to the poor and the young and the unlearned. We see that through Mary and Joseph. But God also shows up to the foreigner and to the wise. God shows up even to Herod and gives opportunity for the privileged and powerful to enter the story. So when we choose to limit who God can work through or who God is showing up to, we miss out on what God is doing. I think the second thing we can pay attention to here is it's hard to give up our own power in order to be in line with what God is doing. Power is always threatened by the loss of its own power. Herod is unable to enter in to what God is doing here because it would mean he would lose his title, his comfort, his privilege. For Herod, maintaining power and control is worth committing violence. But it does raise questions. How does our will and desire for our way thwart our willingness to be faithful? What are we willing to demand others to sacrifice for our own comfort and position? The third one is a little bit more tricky. Efforts to stop God from bringing about shalom, from bringing about God's intention, are not going to be effective. Even as things look bad, even as it's clear that horrific things in the world are happening, God continues to work to bring about what God wills, even in the face of people's best resistance. And I recognize that there's a really hard edge to this story. The wailing herd in Ramah and in Bethlehem isn't comforted by the fact that it's fulfilling prophecy. It's no less painful, even if somehow it can become part of a redemptive plan. That's a hard thing to sit with, and I think we can't just skip over that. Even as we say, in this story, there's the clarity that God continues to do what God is going to do. That God's intention to bring about peace and shalom is still happening. It's a both and it's a hard both and. In the end, God will accomplish what God intends. And there's a hopeful reality in this, even when we feel that there isn't hope, that God is still at work. And the world set right is something that God will see through. And so I think this raises questions for all of us. Where are we limiting our thinking on how God can be at work or who God can speak through? Where are our desires for power or comfort or control placing us to work against what God is doing? Are we paying attention, like we asked last week, to the small things and ways that God is communicating to us? Because we can trust that God is working on communicating with us. And are we willing to be faithful to respond when God does call us to faithfulness, when we know what we're called to? So let's take some time to listen together, to pay attention to what God might be speaking into our midst. And maybe God will have a message for just you, something that you need to hear. Or maybe God has a message through you for a couple other people that they need to hear. Or maybe God has a message through you for all of us. And if that's the case, we ask that you'd stand and wait, and a microphone will be brought so we can hear that word. There'll be some queries up on the screen if they're helpful. If not, feel free to ignore them. Let's listen together.